folks, we are plugged in and ready to rock and roll. Now it's Monday the 26th of March 2018, and you're listening to the Kraz Files podcast with Adam, and as usual everything goes over to the website krazfiles.com, my website, C-R-A-Z-Z. Always plenty to go through, lots of articles and videos, and we've got original articles going up. It's called the Kraz Files Original, so anyone out there who listens to the podcast goes on the website. If you want to write an article, if you have something interesting, send it through to the krazfiles@mail.com, and we can post it as an article, add any links or pictures you might want, keep it short and sweet or long, whatever you want, trying to get people involved and being able to publish their articles on independent websites. So let us know if anyone out there wants to write anything. And the podcasts go over to iTunes as well, and you can get them straight off the website and download them there, whatever you want. They go over to Facebook and Twitter and all of that as well. You can check out opensourcetruth.com, other great website, and other great news feeds on the website as well, like Nexus news feed, and check out Renegade Tribune. Guys doing a great job over there, and we're all good to go. Got a great show, a very special show tonight, because author Thomas Goodridge is back in the chair with me, and great to chat with Tom again tonight. We're going to do about 45 minutes, and looking at my website, the last show I did with Thomas was called State of Chaos with Thomas Goodridge, and that was November the 17th, 2015. I know a lot of listeners follow Kraz Files will be wondering about Tom and his books, but he is back in the saddle for sure, and got some great a fantastic book to cover tonight. So Tom, it's great to have you on the podcast again. I've missed you, man.
Hey Adam, thanks so much for having me. You know, that's a long time. A lot of water flowed under that bridge. 2015 sounds like 1915 almost. It's so far back, but brother, thanks so much for having me on again. It's my pleasure.
You want to we're going to talk about your amazing new book tonight, Summer 1945, Germany, Japan, and the Harvest of Hate. And this is now available, so we're going to kind of melt into this and go through all the relevant points on the book and how folks can get it and how you got there. What's been happening with you? You left the United States and went on a bit of a journey, and you're in Europe at the moment. You want to, you got the floor, bring us up to date with how you've been and your books and how everything's traveling for you on your end?
It's a little bit like this. It's life. I've gone through a few things, and I won't get into them all, but as you know, and perhaps some of your listeners know, I've spent the last 10 years in Florida, which is, of course, it's a deep state in America, always hot. And I'll be honest with you, I got very tired of that constant heat, because I'm actually from northern latitudes, the four seasons, where you actually get snow and cold, which is, it's not terribly good when you're going through it, but it does provide variety, and Florida has none. Perhaps about the only other constant other than the heat is hurricanes. I'm not real keen on that either. I went through one just before I left. But Adam, it's a number of things. A divorce, how about that? That's never a good thing, I suppose. Wait a minute, let me go back. Yeah, people don't get divorced to be unhappy. They get divorced to be happy. And so it's the situation leading to divorce that's bad. But the divorce itself, it's done for a reason, to try to find happiness. So you might say that when I left the U.S., all those things were in play, not the least the hurricane, of course, and the heat, but the divorce and things like that. And let's just call me a vagabond historian right now. I'm roaming the earth looking for something. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but maybe it's that happiness. Right now I'm in, let's just call it darkest Denmark right now. I'm previously I was in Germany, and I left there, which that's a misnomer, left. I feel like I actually escaped from Germany. Germany, formerly happy, formerly free, is none of those things now. It's actually in lockdown. It's a police state, Stasi, modern communists right now have total control in this lockdown. They arrest grandmothers for saying wrong things or for thinking wrong things now, Germany. It's great if you're a tourist. Yeah, the beer gardens, enjoying the scenery and the beauty. And the people are still great, I've got to tell you, even though they're slaves right now, the Germans. Despite the flood of illegal immigrants, so third world refugees, let's call them what they call them, third world refugees, despite that, Germany still has some things going for it, but ultimately it's probably one of the most enslaved nations on earth today. I don't know of any other worse. But yeah, I escaped from Germany in Denmark. I may be headed to Amman, Jordan soon, or Italy, or Ireland. I'm not sure which, but there's your vagabond for you. But other than that, I think for an old man, I'm doing pretty good. I still have my wheels. I'm still trying to take care of myself. And of course, I'm still writing, although the book we'll talk a little bit about today probably will be my last book, quite honestly. I've got to be doing something else, something more important. Some people say you can do nothing more important than write these kind of books, but I think there is a higher calling for me. Maybe just to go to South Africa and help those poor people down there, maybe something like that. I'm not sure, but I got to hurry up and do it because I'm getting old, and I want to leave this earth with self-respect. And I want to leave knowing that I've done everything I possibly could to help this earth. And believe me, the earth right now needs a lot of help. The good news, though, Adam, as you know better than most, is that we're starting to get a lot of that help now. Ever since the internet came in, ever since people like yourself with podcasts and websites came in, our numbers are growing tremendously. Most people, it doesn't seem like it, but to old guys like me, it looks like it's happening with the speed of light. We're winning. It doesn't seem like it to a lot of people because we're not winning now. But I'm telling you, in the long run, we're going to win because we are winning. There's no way to deny it. So there's lots of good things, but it's like old guys like me. I want to see the win. I want to see a victory. I won't, of course, unless I live to be 200, and I know I will. But ultimately, that's it. There's the book that I'm going to talk a little bit about, Summer 1945, Germany, Japan, and the Harvest of Hate. This is a follow-up book to Hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944-1947. And we've talked about that on the program before. It's a book that many people have heard of, and quite a few people have actually read. And I think there's no need to talk too much about that except it's a book, Hellstorm, that is. It's a book that tells what really happened to Germany at the end of the war. It doesn't go through everything. It doesn't go through battles, really. But it tells what the German people actually went through. It's nothing like, well, let's put it this way. This is the only book that at least attempts to tell what the so-called good war and the greatest generation that won that good war actually did to the losers of this war. This is the first book, in the words of the folks themselves, the people who survived, what they passed. And quite honestly, it's the darkest and best kept secret on earth, what happened to the Germans and the German nation. And so, with that said about Hellstorm, Summer 1945 is an attempt to follow up on that. It's an attempt to show. Okay, first of all, the title, Summer 1945. Some people may wonder why that title. Because that was the first summer of so-called peace for Germany. And that was the last summer of absolute, utter, horrific war for Japan. So it's these two nations. Basically, it's Hellstorm, only this is around the globe. It shows what is going on to Japan at the same time. Honestly, what was happening to Germany in that so-called summer of peace after German surrender was not a hell of a lot different than what the Japanese were going through in war. The death, the destruction, the chaos, the rapes, the torture, it's almost indescribable what is going on in Germany during the so-called summer of peace. Actually, it's just war by other means. The war continues in Germany. Now, this is the book I'm talking about, summer 1945. The Americans came in, and, you know, in the United States, there's a lot of folks who still believe this, that the Americans were the greatest generation, that is, those of the 1940s, and that this was a good war. Of course, this is phrases used by Jews because it was a good war for the Jewish power structure in the world. It was a great war, as a matter of fact. They, as they're doing today in Muslim nations, they're getting the United States and other countries to do their bidding. They're not risking a thing. That is the Jews, Jew power structure. They're not only getting us to fight and die for their wars, as they were doing during World War II, but they're getting us to pay for these wars. And so that continues. That goes on to this very day. But when the Americans came in, many Jews were right behind them. Jews who had fled Germany in the 1930s to escape Nazism and had went to America or Great Britain or Australia or New Zealand. And when they came back in, they... How do I want to say this? They were determined to punish Germany to the highest extent. There's something called the Morgenthau Plan. Perhaps you've heard of it, I'm sure, and some of your listeners. It was named after Franklin Delano Roosevelt, his Secretary of Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, who was a Jew, of course, as were many surrounding Roosevelt. And by the way, on the subject of Roosevelt, in my opinion, he is one of the greatest war criminals in world history, period. I don't care what anybody says about him. I don't care what their attempts are to turn him into a great hero. No, anybody who does what he did, that is calculate and sneak and deceive and get America into one of the worst wars in world history, and not only get us into it, but force us basically to amplify and make this war even more terrible. That's a war criminal to me, a great war criminal. But anyway, the Morgenthau Plan was Roosevelt's and Eisenhower's and General Marshall's and the Jewish power structure in America, their attempt to destroy Germany, not just in name, not just in fancy, but in reality, utterly, to get rid of Germany, to kill off Germany. That's the plan. Basically, it's once we defeat Germany, and they knew they were going to defeat Germany. After America came in, it was going to be easy, actually, with the Soviet Union, Great Britain, France, the other allied nations, was to destroy Germany. If during the war itself, they did their best to kill as many civilians, men, women, children, old people, pets, as they possibly could. And they did with firebombing. This is one of the highest war crimes of all time, firebombing. Firebombing every German city. And they did a very good job of it. Germany was like the face of the moon after the war. Millions of people had been killed. But after the war, after the so-called surrender and the peace, then they really went to work. They began, of course, with Eisenhower's death camps, by killing roughly 1.5 million helpless, disarmed German POWs. This is after the war, too, by the way, through starvation, dehydration, actual murder, disease. basically putting them in concentration camps that have no shelter, no cover, and above all, no food. Eisenhower's plan was to deny food, water, medicine, everything to the Germans, these disarmed German soldiers, and he did a very good job of it. But in the civilian areas, there is an attempt to starve out Germans. That was the plan, starve roughly 50 million Germans after the war. And they did a pretty good job of it, actually, denying food that was available from Switzerland, from Denmark, from other countries, not allowing it to enter Germany so that the German people could survive. By the tens of thousands, the hundreds of thousands, these people died. And again, keeping in mind the Morgenthau plan, the deliberate attempt to kill Germany, utterly, people, nation, everywhere. And it was calculated with the Morgenthau plan at this rate, in a few years, basically, Germany would cease to exist. The surrounding nations like Czechoslovakia, Poland, it was known that their deep hatred of Germany, of course, they would have attacked Germany once it could never, ever defend itself. Yes, and so Germany would disappear. But this is the Morgenthau plan, and incidentally, the Morgenthau plan has never been rescinded. It is still in place. You can witness it today throughout Germany. You can see it. This invasion, this attempt to repopulate Germany with another species, and it's working. It's still going on, this Morgenthau plan, this Jewish attempt to destroy Germany. But what is also going on, as we can now see vividly, it's all around us, is a Morgenthau plan for all of the white world, not just Germany. This is going on too. This attempt to unseat us, to remove us from our own nations and replace us with alien third world populations that are violent prone, criminals, rapists. So we have this going on around the world right now. But while this was going on in Germany, just after the war, the torture, I'm leaving out lots of stuff because this is going to be a short program, but the tortures. One of the things they wanted to do was sterilize all Germans that did not starve to death in this initial attempt to starve out Germany. They wanted to sterilize them, keep them from having babies, so there would be no more Germans from that area. And as odd and vicious as it seems, much of the sterilization was not through chemicals or medicine. This was through actual destruction of male reproductive organs. I'm very serious about that. As freaky as that sounds, don't forget, we've got Jews doing a lot of the torturing, a lot of this interrogation, so-called interrogation. Because, like I said, after the war, they show no mercy on anyone. They're there for vengeance, and they're going to get their vengeance. And they got their vengeance, because we've got torture camps set up throughout Germany under the auspices of America. We've also got Jewish-run, Jewish-operated torture centers throughout Poland. And what happened there is it's hard to believe. I can't go through it right now because but what happened there to these people, it's on another planet. It's not something your average white person even understands. We don't have that in our culture, in our psyche. We don't have that. But while this so-called summer of peace is going on in Germany, this mass slaughter, this mass torture, this mass rape, massive rapes, this attempt to destroy Germany over the next several years. In Japan, we're going through the final war, the final summer of war. And let me say this. This probably resonates with Australians more than other people in the world. I'm an American, by the way. I grew up in that period right after the war. I grew up hating dirty Japs. I didn't particularly hate Germans because I'm part German. But I grew up hating the dirty Japs because that's all you got on the TV and the movies, were the dirty Japs sneaking around in palm trees, shooting helpless civilians, implicit rape, just terrible, terrible people, these Japanese. his work. Well, let me say this to the Australians listening, and to the Americans, to the New Zealanders. Everything you've heard about the war with Japan and World War II, forget it. Forget it. Because that's what happened to me when I started researching this book. I went in with preconceived notions about the war with Japan, and when I finally finished the research in the first draft of this book, I knew that I had to forget everything I thought about the Japanese. They have come down to us as hardly human, as a terrible, deceitful trick, as a terrible, untrustworthy people who prefer to die for the emperor, prefer to sneak up on people, cut their throats, and do the most terrible things on earth. Well, I found out if you reverse this situation, if you put this in, if you, everything you think you know about the Japanese in the war, if you actually transfer that to the Americans, and I hate to say it too, but also the Australians, if you transfer that to them, then you're coming closer to the mark. First and foremost, one of the things I found out right off the top, I think most of your listeners know something about Pearl Harbor and the deceit of FDR behind that, trying to goad the Japanese into such an attack. Don't forget, Japan had been under quarantine for the previous year before Pearl Harbor. In other words, they had been put in a position, an act of war, actually, a quarantine, more or less, an attempt by America to force Japan into doing something radical so that America could get into the war with Germany, as Franklin Roosevelt and his Jewish advisors wanted more than anything on earth. They didn't care about Japan. They knew that would be a walk in the park. They could defeat Japan in 3 months. The Americans knew that, so they were not worried about Japan. But they had to force Japan to attack somewhere to give us a pretext to get into the war with Europe, with Germany, because Japan and Germany had a defensive treaty. And, of course, once Japan did something and went to war with America, America would be at war with Japan. And as a consequence of the war, at a war with Germany. And so the Jews in America and elsewhere, the world Jewish power structure, could defeat Nazi Germany. But after Pearl Harbor, a race who prior to Pearl Harbor, had been universally acknowledged as a proud, dignified, honorable race of people who kept their word, who were honest, who were noble. To put it in perspective, were noble. Actually, these are not my words. These books, Hellstorm and Summer 1945, are not my words. These are the words of the people themselves. They're telling me the story. I'm simply transferring it to a book, paper, print. They're telling me these stories. So what you get with these books are the people. And after Pearl Harbor, these formerly well-liked and honorable people, to all the people of the earth, now became dirty Japs, yellow rats, vampire bats. They became everything except human. In other words, the propaganda machine in America went to work on them, and it was a relatively easy matter to turn what had been a proud, dignified people before Pearl Harbor into vicious, depraved subhumans. And that's the way they remained for the next 4 and 5 years. In fact, that's where they still remain in popular mythology of World War II. The fact is that the Japanese, after the Pearl Harbor and then after the American invasion of the very first island, Guadalcanal, the pattern was set. Americans were not going to take any prisoners. They were told not to. Now, this isn't something that was codified. It was not broadcast. It was not put into paper. It was not made a law. It was just simply understood. Understood. People, when they came up, when they landed on the first island, Guadalcanal, and from every island after that, they understood, we will take no prisoners. It was said by officers, colonels, generals. Everybody admitted that. It was not printed, so they didn't want the average American knowing about this. However, the average American would not have given a damn, quite honestly, at that time. That's how big the transformation was of the Japanese from humans to animals to beasts. And so we have this situation starting at Guadalcanal all the way through to Okinawa, the final island battle, in which we have Japanese who are very human, by the way. These are not the mindless robotic type of creatures that you've been led to believe in the movies and books and TV. These are human beings. And that's something else that was rather sobering to me to find out. They had virtually the same desires, wants, expectations as the Americans they were fighting, the Australians they were fighting. In other words, they were not nuts about war, despite what the Americans might have thought. They had been at war with China for years. They were tired of war. In fact, in Guadalcanal, we have this happening. We have Japanese who find themselves surrounded and who want to give up. This is the first battle, don't forget. And they are signers of the Geneva Convention with America, and they believe in the Geneva Convention about the treatment of captured enemy combatants, and they believe that they can actually surrender, despite this idea of Japs fighting to the death for the emperor, willing to die, wanting to die. Not so. From the very first, when Japanese realized they couldn't get their way out of a certain situation, they threw down their guns and walked forward, saying the only word they knew in English, mercy, mercy, mercy. In other words, with their hands up. And from the very first attempt to do that, they were mowed down by machine guns, mowed down. And can you imagine this happening again and again, not just on Guadalcanal, but every island to follow? It soon becomes clear to the rest of the Japanese, hey, we cannot surrender. There is no surrender here. And so the people, the comrades of these who were slaughtered by the Americans, just outright murdered in cold blood, they see this. They're waiting from the bushes, breathlessly watching, hoping their comrades are accepted. And when they see they're not, when they see they're just mindlessly shot down, and then worse than that, when they see that the ones who aren't dead quite yet, or haven't died yet, when they see that they are tortured, or they see what happens to them, the ones that are still alive, or the ones who manage to get captured, when they see the Americans torturing them, they see the Americans beating them, when they see the Americans kicking their teeth out to get their gold teeth, when they see the Americans cutting off their ears and noses, and heads even, for souvenirs. What do you think the ones in the bush are thinking when they see this? They say to themselves, under no circumstances will I ever surrender to these people. Not to go through this, not to be tortured to death, not to be humiliated, denigrated, and then murdered. It's very much like the American cavalrymen of the Indian Wars in America, fighting the Sioux, the Cheyenne, the Comanche on the plains. They did something that the Japanese, that is, did something that the American soldiers had done fighting the Indians. To avoid this torture, they did kill themselves. They saved the last bullet for themselves. That's a phrase, and it means exactly what it means. Never allow yourself to fall into enemy hands. This is what they do to you. And so we have this spectacle of Japanese who actually run out of ammunition in the fight, and then who actually walk in front of Americans to draw a bullet to kill them. Now, that's the way this went all the way through to the final battle in Okinawa. Of course, the Japanese were no longer surrendering. One officer said, look, if we could have been able to surrender, we would have done it by the hundreds of thousands. They knew they were going to get beat. They understood that they were outmatched. The Americans had everything that the Japanese didn't have, especially the air superiority. Americans owned the air. They could strafe and bomb at leisure. And so, nevertheless, the only alternative was what? To fight, continue to fight to the end, to the bitter end. American propaganda, of course, turned that into the Japanese were mindless robots, subhumans who loved dying for the emperor, who actually loved committing suicide, which is bogus bullshit. The Japanese were very much like their opposites, the Americans and the Australians and the British. But that's one of the first great revelations of this book, summer 1945 was this entire scenario. It was also heartbreaking to find certain accounts by certain Americans and Australians who had not totally bought into this entire Japanese as subhuman propaganda, because they had a way of saying something about the Japanese that they really didn't perhaps appreciate. For instance, stealing things from dead Japanese or living Japanese, for that matter. Finding things like this, finding fold-up, pin-ups in the Japanese helmet of beautiful Japanese actresses, just like the Americans folded up pin-ups, pin-up girls in their own helmets. That suddenly brings them very close to you. Or seeing photographs of Japanese soldiers that are now dead or tortured without their heads back home prior to the war, playing a photograph of them, playing in the backyard with a bunch of licking, wagging puppies, doing virtually the same thing most Americans had done in their lives. So many things, so many common things that they had. Suddenly, some of the American soldiers, the Marines, and Australians realized that maybe we're not so different after all. Some of those things were very touching when you read them in the words of the people themselves. But again, not just for the Japanese soldier, but for the entire Japanese nation, it was a war of no mercy. Germany, prior to the so-called peace, had just been bombed back to the Stone Age by the Americans and the British in their firebombing raids that killed millions of people. Millions. Japan also, beginning in March of 1945, the Americans began their firebombing mission on the cities of Japan. After they got close enough, they turned the B-29s loose and firebombed virtually every city, every large city, and many smaller cities, as a matter of fact. Even small towns sometimes got it. Firebombing, and millions more died in Japan. Firebombing, for anyone who doesn't know anything about it, this is one of the most utter and remorseless ways of destroying cities and the people, and women and children, the animals, ever invented. There's nothing quite like firebombing, because it is a deliberate attempt to kill every living thing down below, simply put. Fire to burn not just the town, but the people. Tokyo was the first city firebombed in March of 1945, and it set a pattern for all the way to the end of the war what the Americans were going to do. Let me give you an example of Tokyo, especially. The Americans planned a roughly, I think it's 400 or 500 B-29 bombers to come in and drop 500,000 firebombs. Smaller bombs, but much more deadly than the explosive bomb. And they came in that night, the first pathfinders, and they marked the center of Tokyo with a large X. The initial pathfinder bombers, they came in and just actually made a large X right in the middle of the most densely populated area of Tokyo, where 1.5 million people live. And then other bombers came in, other planes, and dropped more firebombs that made a gigantic circle, 16-mile circle around the center, so that nobody could miss this. No bomber, no B-29 dropping its phosphorus and napalm could not see this target from above. And the bombers are flying in very low, too. They're suddenly using 5 and 9,000 feet altitudes to make sure they land every bomb exactly where they want them. And they also made sure that it was a very windy night. They picked that because that would not only enhance the impact of the flames, the firestorms, but it would ensure that fewer people got away. In other words, we're talking about women and children mostly, and the old people. The young men are gone. They're fighting against the Americans on the islands and elsewhere on the Asian mainland. And so we've got the same population in Japan that we have in Germany. We've got the least likely to escape, the most vulnerable people. And sure enough, yes, this night, when the bombers came in, they dropped their bombs. They allowed the winds to blow these along at hurricane-force winds. And of course, people died by the hundreds of thousands. There was no way to escape. They couldn't outrun these things. There was, and Japanese homes, let's not forget, are made of wood and paper. Unlike German homes, which were made of stone and rock and wood. And even in Germany, of course, the people could not get away. The Japanese were incinerated by the hundreds of thousands, the old, the slow. And interestingly enough, the following day, and not, don't forget, this was utter in its destruction. An area of Tokyo of 1.5 million. But after the Tokyo raid, the American estimates, this is for American consumption as well, American civilian consumption, estimated that 100,000 people died during that initial raid. Of course, Americans were elated. They wanted the Japanese to die. They hated them as much as their sons and fathers who were fighting and killing the Japanese mercilessly. But this idea of 100,000 people dying in this raid, this particular raid on Tokyo that night, is bogus. It's bullshit, and it's done in it's done on purpose. They know that someday someone will write about this firestorm in Japan, in Tokyo. And they don't want to sound any worse than they really are. They're absolute evil criminals, in my opinion. The people who planned this, the people who executed it. But they want the numbers to stay relatively low because they don't want to look like the mass murderers that they are and were and unfortunately still are in wars. 1.5 million people lived in that area. It was destroyed absolutely. There was nothing left, utterly. Now, a few people did get away. Some of them fled to the river. Some fled to open spaces, parks, where American pilots and P-47s were on targets of opportunity, were shooting down refugees. These are fighter planes who are ordered to kill those who survive and who are trying to escape over the river, along the banks. They're also killing Japanese. So we've got an area of 1.5 million. How many do you think died in that? I'm telling you that the entire area was destroyed. Those who got away were few. And I'm listening to the people who did get away. I'm listening to the Americans above watching down below as they drop their bombs. Some of them tell the truth. Some say what it was really about. I'm telling you straight, 100,000 is a joke. It's a lie. Probably closer to 1 million. 1 million perished in that single firestorm bombing raid. Firestorm is remorseless. There's very little you can do. And the Japanese had no place to hide underneath, down in the ground. Their small, primitive air raid shelters were just holes in the ground. They thought the only raids on Japan would be from explosives. So they built their original air raid shelters, which are just basically each home doing its own thing with that, digging their own holes, was to avoid the blast and the shrapnel from high explosives. They had no concept of fire bombings, fire storms, fire swept by hurricane force winds. And so I'm saying, in my opinion, I wasn't there, of course, but I've got a pretty good feel for this. I'm saying at least 1 million people, mostly, virtually all women, children, old people, died that one single night in Tokyo. And this went on now for the next 5 and 6 months while the war lasted until Nagasaki and Hiroshima. But this is an American attempt. It's the same thing they were doing in Europe, in Germany, to destroy all of the people, period. But this, I'm giving you some of the things that are in this book right now. There's lots I could talk about. There's the book, as I mentioned earlier, the book is about both countries, what they went through, what it was like for both countries to lose the world's worst war, the most homicidal, the most vicious, the most depraved, the most evil of all wars ever begun, ever fought, ever concluded. And what followed was also the worst peace. I do, of course, discuss Japan and Nagasaki and Hiroshima and how they were unnecessary. Japan had been trying to surrender since January 1945. And they were refused by FDR because he actually enjoyed the war and so did the American people. And a war that's going this great, it's many Japanese that are dying. Who wants to end it? Nobody in America, nobody in the military. But they could have. They could have accepted the Japanese surrender in January of 1945 and saved hundreds of thousands of lives, not just Japanese, but Americans and Australians and English as the great and the Britons. But it's I think I'm talking myself out right now at this point. I'm more or less, Adam, can you throw in a question you've got, maybe a thought, because maybe it'll spur me on to.
No, I'm just in, you know, really listening to this, and you know, we can't do a lot in the hour, Tom, but it's a history lesson for myself as well, and it's a remarkable thing, you know, because you know you think you know, all throughout history, and it's almost saturated right through our lives. I mean, it's all through our schooling system. It's coming at you through the movie screens and through the newspapers. It's so overwhelming, the whole Holocaust of the so-called 6 million Jews, and you know, committed by the evil Nazis, and it was the Jewish people that copped all the brutal punishment and were slaughtered in the millions, and all of this. And we have these movies come out now about Churchill, you know, these propaganda movies. It's kind of amazing. And, you know, so many people, you know, think that way. And it's these books that you're writing, they're just quite incredible, you know, and it's just astonishing.
You know, you know, Adam,
I don't know what to say about it. It's just so unbelievable what has happened in our past, that we've not been taught or shown or any of this in, you know. No one has a clue that this went on in history. It's all about, you know, the sympathy for the Jews who got slaughtered. And it just amazes me. It just leaves me speechless.
You spurred me to some new thoughts. Yes, of course. Virtually all the crimes committed against Germany and Japan were projected back on them, the losers, that is. The winners can do anything they want, actually. After all, they won the war. And in this case, it was a Jewish world power that won the war. So they were capable of transferring all of the crimes committed against Germany in this case, or Japan in the other case, against them. And there's very little the losers can do. Let's face it. Japan, when the Americans finally occupied Japan, MacArthur, they censored everything. I mean, there was nothing coming out of Japan that the Americans didn't want coming out, including knowledge about what really happened at Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And by the way, that's another story that's in this book. It's something different altogether. But yes, you're right. We are saturated, infested with the winner's version of World War II. And yes. I think anybody who's read Hellstorm, anybody who reads this next book, will realize that this is the greatest lie perpetrated on humans in world history ever. This total transference from the so-called bad guys of World War II, the losers, the transfer of evil onto the losers from the winners. This there is, I don't have any other way of saying this, of phrasing it, except that we have been, let's put it, humans are pretty lazy lot. We're pretty lazy. We'd rather get our knowledge free and easy while we're sitting, doing nothing, not researching, not talking with survivors, not forcing yourself to libraries, not going through the grueling work of researching and writing a book. So it's easier to watch a movie. It's easier to listen to a TV report or someone proclaim what the Good War was all about to Americans and Aussies and Brits. Because we won the war. We. Of course we didn't, but we wrote the history. We did the movies. We made the movies. And it's easy to believe that because then it means you can get on with whatever it is you're doing at the clubs and nightclubs, at the bars, whatever, or playing sports, whatever, watching sports. But it makes someone like me furious. And it's something I really didn't want to write another book, but I felt I had with I felt I had to show what the world was going through, not just Europe, not just Germany. I had to show what Japan was going through. And the parallels are incredible. Now, Japan was not a threat to Jewish world power, not yet anyway. But maybe someday they would be. But the Americans, everybody knew that we were going to defeat Japan easily. Japan was only 100 years removed from the feudal age, let's face it. Their officers with swords in hand were actually out directing anti-aircraft fire with swords. I mean, there's so many things about Japan was 19th century. It was a 19th century nation fighting a modern superpower, a 20th century superpower. And so Japan had been goaded into that war, and they obediently jumped into it. They had to, or perish. But to this very day, though, this very day, of course, Germany is, I mentioned the Morgenthau Plan, this attempt to destroy utterly Germany, and it's still in place. It's still going on. But now it's entered all other white nations. It's not just Germany any longer. Now, Japan, this is not Japan we see today. This is not the Japanese culture, psychology at work. This is an American creation. America gave Japan no more freedom than Americans and their Jewish bosses gave them Germans after the war. Germany's still occupied. You can see it. Germans would never tolerate this almost unstoppable mass migration of third world rapists and murderers, lazy, good-for-nothing people to their country. Germans would not allow that. But this ugly regime that they have in place right now, sure, that's their part of the Morgenthau Plan, these Merkel types that allow it, encourage it, arrest grandmothers for arguing against it. And all people have to do is use their minds, look around, see things, and understand what is going on in the world. Yes, it helps if they read books like my books and like many other books, by the way. Lots of other patriots are writing about this too. But coming to someone like myself, who is probably much like listeners right now, who totally bought into the lies, who accepted them, who it worked. Yes, who doesn't want their nation, their race, the Americans, the white race, to win, to beat the hell out of somebody? It gives you a real satisfaction, a smugness that you're number one, you're good, you're great. The fact is, in Germany anyway, we were defeating ourselves, as we all know. I'm German, 50 million Americans are Germans, part Germans. So it was a civil war and a murder of each other. In Japan, it was different. Japanese are a different race, of course. They're Asian. And it was easier to hate them, which I did, gladly, when I was a kid. And a young man. Yeah, even a middle-aged man. And then I found out the truth. I found out that the Japanese are just as good as we are. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. No, they're different. Yeah, I understand that. No, I'm not going to marry one. But in their own culture, in their own manner, they have this wonderful curiosity. It's a naive curiosity. They're very curious about things. And I'm not sure. I'm at a loss for words, generally, because I'm trying to drift through this as best I can, and I'm pulling up thoughts that I haven't even thought before. they seemingly willingly accepted the American idea of culture after the war. I don't think it was so willing. I think there's a real Japan there. And I'm not saying they want to go back to Shogun. They want to go back to Bushido and the samurai and the feudal wars that they went through. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying they would like, if they ever had the opportunity, if they ever got the freedom to develop on their own, to develop their own art, their own culture. And I guarantee you, it wouldn't be the American culture. Most Americans hate this culture, we call our culture, this ugly Jewish monstrosity that's been foisted upon us, this seemingly insatiable craze for sex and pornography and just vicious depravity. This is not a white man's culture. And the Japanese, of course, they probably feel even more alienated from their culture than we do from ours. And so, no, I told a friend the other day, I want to live long enough to at least see the nations who did this, the German and Japan. I want to see their leaders of today apologize for what their nations did in the past. Just the apology for this massive slaughter and this replacement of the people and their culture. And then perhaps monuments can be raised to this. I'm not doing either book justice right now because, as I say, it's in the words of the people themselves, both books. And they tell what it's like to go through all this, the torture, the rapes. And by the way, I don't think it's any secret anymore, hopefully, that millions of German women were raped after the war. Not just by the soldiers of the Red Army, but by the Americans of the U.S. Army. In some cases, the French, but mostly the Soviet soldiers and the American soldiers. They were turned loose on German womanhood, and their crimes against women was almost as great as the massacres from the air, on the sea, and on the land. In other words, their massacre was a spiritual massacre of German womanhood. And the same thing occurred in Japan. From Saipan and Okinawa all the way to the occupation of Japan itself. The Americans were known as rapists, and they lived up to that all the way. American officers either turned the other way or simply laughed at what they were doing. They felt they earned it, deserved it. The Japanese were animals, got everything they deserved. And so the rape of Japan and Germany, that's one of the best-kept secrets right now in world history, this massive rape. And often followed by murder of German women, Japanese women. It's certainly something that still needs to be publicized over and over because I'm sure, although you hear nothing about it, I'm sure American soldiers are doing the same thing right now in the Middle East, raping Muslim women, probably in the hundreds of thousands, just because we're not hearing anything about it. I tell you right now, we've got the history to go on. American armies without the American army without officers to control them, force discipline on them, are as bad as any army ever walked the earth. They run loose, they commit terrible crimes, rape. That's a joke. It's something understood. That's what Americans expect. The spoils of war, this horizontal conquering of an enemy. This goes on, but also this massacre of enemy soldiers. You know, the Geneva Convention, Germany adhered to the Geneva Convention as well as any nation has ever adhered to it. Those are not my words. These are people who talked about this, neutral observers. The Americans, on the other hand, laugh at the Geneva Convention. It's nothing to them. It's a piece of paper. Eisenhower proves it. His soldiers prove it. It's something they can laugh at. They told the captives, forget the convention. Forget the Geneva Convention. You have no rights. And virtually the same thing happened with Japan. Japan, we've heard a lot about Japan, how terrible it is. And by the way, I want to say this real quick. These two books, Hellstorm and Summer 1945, these two books do not give a damn about all the crimes supposedly committed by Germany and Japan. doesn't give a damn about that, because there are thousands of books out there you can pick up any day in the library, the bookstore. There are thousands or hundreds at least of movies and films you can go to, and they'll tell you what the Americans want you to know. They can tell you about all the cruelty of the Germans and Japanese, all the crimes they committed. Whether they did or not, sure, I'm sure some of them were committed. But if you want that approach, just go there. These books are about what we did to the Germans and Japanese. And these, to my knowledge, are the the only two books that try to take it all the way to the bitter end. And these are going to be my last two books. These, in other words, I'm tired of wading through such terrible things. I felt I had to. I felt I had to write both books because nobody else was. And, you know, Adam, there's something in all of us, I think. All of us who care, all of us who have a brain to think with, all of us who want to leave some sort of legacy in this world, I think we're all alike in that sense that when we're in our final moments, in the last seconds, and we know it, and we're staring up the lights if we're lucky enough to be in a hospital, or if we're laying in a bloody ditch after being mortally wounded, we want in that last moment to think, have I done anything? We will have this thought. Well, have I done anything in this world? Have I really done anything with my life to improve this world? And God forbid you're laying there and you say, no, I have not. Because that's going to be a very lonely death. You're not going to be taking anything with you. And so I encourage everybody who's listening to this to do whatever you can. And with this life you have, everything you can to improve this world, whether it's, I like to think I'm spreading truth. I like to think I'm telling the truth to people for a change. But I encourage you to do whatever you can for freedom, for truth, for honesty, for integrity. Do whatever you can. If it's giving money to people like Adam on the Crisis Files, please do. He's like every other webcast out there, every other website. Money is an issue. It's always going to be an issue. The other side has billions, trillions of dollars to work with. Adam has hundreds. Do whatever you can to help Adam and others. If not Adam, then others who are doing much the same work. If you can't give money, if you're poor like Adam and I, do something else. Offer your help. Offer your energy. Offer your talent. If it's something to do with computers, offer that. If it's something to do with writing, please give that. There are so many things you could do if you just willed yourself to do it. But for God's sakes, don't have that last moment of your life and ask yourself, did I do enough? And you come up with the answer, no, I didn't, because that's something you seriously don't want to take with you to eternity. But Adam, unless you've got any questions, I think I probably bored the people enough with my droning and my coughing.
It's remarkable. It's remarkable. And yeah, indeed, Tom. And you know, when I got Hellstorm, the book, your book, and when I first started reading that, it was like a hand got punched through my stomach, you know, and grabbed onto my intestines. That's what it felt like, reading that book. It's like someone just punched right through my stomach and grabbed a whole handful of my intestines and wouldn't let go. And you just can't believe that human beings did that. But it's something that I always said about you, that must be so hard to write, you know. It must have been so hard to write that. And then for Kyle to do the documentary, Hellstorm, you know, to invite that into your life, it's so horrible. And you've done it again with a new book. And it's but it's you know, we have to know thy enemy, you know. You have to know what we're dealing with, what kind of ghouls we're dealing with on planet Earth. And that book is a very shattering book, Tom. So I assume this is a from what you've been saying tonight on the podcast, this is a sort of a continuation of that. But, you know, just as well, looking at the Japanese, I've always thought that as well. I've thought that, you know, with the Japanese people, they're that one race of people that is so similar to Western people, to white people. You don't get that with other Asian cultures and stuff. I don't anyway. I always found the Japanese people to be, as you said, very polite and well-mannered, and they had their own unique culture, and their beautiful culture throughout history, if anyone wants to have a look at it, you know, amazing. And how they, you know, they were demonized. As you grow up as a boy, you know, going through, you always think they were evil people and very nasty and, you know, all of this. But they're one race of people that seem very special and very connected to the way we do things in the West. And it makes it all sadder, that bit more sadder when, as you were mentioning there, that they did want that type of life that the Americans had, and they probably didn't even know why they were fighting. And they do seem like such a wonderful people, and it's I guess so important that you've added this extra book on to cover this part, because it really will show people, you know, what happened, as well as Germany. The same thing happened. And committed by the same people. You mentioned a few names there. Unbelievable. I think we could do a whole podcast on Churchill, who's made out to be a saint, and they've got movies on him now, and everyone's going to the cinema to watch how Churchill saved Europe in the final hours. it's just... I guess we could do a whole show on these horrific people and what they did and what they were involved with. But it's an important thing that we've done, and I can't wait to get into it myself, although it's your books aren't easy to read. They're not easy to read. You know, they're very upsetting, you know, because as you said earlier in the podcast, I don't know. It's just not in many of us, even to come to terms, to even try to think of the stuff, the material in your books, and what was done to other human beings. It's just it's, you know, so horrific and so sad. You know.
You know, the fact is, the bad guys won World War II. The good guys lost. Simple as that. Evil triumphed. I want to say just a few more things. And, you know, Summer 1945 and Hellstorm are the two most important books I have ever done or ever will do. It's as simple as that. They are books that reveal what the world is really about and how the force of evil goes about doing it and is still doing it, by the way. Anyone who can read these two books and not come away without a sea change in their view of World War II, or indeed a sea change in their view of the world period, itself, the world, is either dead or simply incapable of thinking, quite honestly. And in other words, these books are in the words of the people themselves. These are not Thomas Goodrich's words, really. They're not. I'm simply hearing what they're saying, and I'm putting it into the book. These are victims' books. The same evil forces who did this to these people is still with us, of course, and they're still practicing their evil. But my belief, Adam, is that if everyone in the world could somehow read these books, yeah, it would help if they bought them, but if they can't, or just borrow them from libraries, if they're in libraries. But it's my personal opinion, if everyone in the world could read these books, I'm convinced that we would soon reach critical mass of action and commitment for change. I truly believe that. I believe you cannot escape the reality of these books, the truth. Now, this might sound like I am tooting my own horn, because they do have my name on them, books, and like I'm bragging about my own power and persuasiveness of myself. I am not. I have never considered these my books, as I've just said. They are victims' books. The books of the victims themselves. This is their only chance to tell what it was like. Those who were murdered, in the firestorms of Germany and Japan. Those women who were raped and who are still not really human today after being gang raped by hundreds of soldiers. Those who were tortured, in some cases tortured to death. In some cases, they wish they'd been killed because some of them are still alive, believe it or not. And those who were the victims of this great evil called America, Great Britain, their allies, the victims, this is their books in their own words. If I could, I'd give away the copies of this book, these books, to everybody on earth. If I could afford that, I would. And then I'd pay people to read it if I had that kind of money. That's how important these books are to me. And that's how important I think this message is that's in these books. By the way, anybody who wants to follow up on anything I've said here, hopefully, thomasgoodrich.com is my website. It's Thomas Goodrich, one word, thomasgoodrich.com. And you can go there. And I don't know. My email address is mtgoodrich@aol.com. mtgoodrich@aol.com. And anybody who has any thoughts, I'd be happy to hear them. Or any criticism, that's fine with me too. But I think, Adam, these are my last two books. You mentioned that you felt like somebody had just punched a hole in your stomach and pulled out your guts. it's very much the same thing researching day by day books like this, and then actually writing out a rough draft and then repeating the draft until you finally have a book. It's very much like that. My soul has been scarred beyond.
People haven't read Hellstorm, they won't know. If they haven't read your book Hellstorm, mm-hmm. they won't know what we're talking about until you read that. Because I've talked to people about it, and they're clueless about what happened in Germany, let alone this book. I mean, they are absolutely clueless. It's all about the Jews and the Holocaust. Then some of them just don't seem interested, but I'm very shocked at how many people have no idea that this went on in German cities, the rapes, the carpet bombings, the mass death.
The torture.
There's the worst that any we have ever seen on planet Earth, and they don't know a thing about it. It's all about sympathy for the Jews and the Jewish Holocaust museums.
What they went through,
and it was unbelievable that they were able to twist that all around and make it all about them and hide the real truth under this. It's remarkable.
Yes, this ignorant person you're describing, this person who does not know and does not care, and they're also very prevalent in Germany, unfortunately, and Japan. If you can imagine that the victims actually, and the descendants of the victims don't really care, don't want to know. At least that's the way it seems now. We both know that things can happen rather quickly. So, believe me, I'll never stop fighting. Just because I won't write any more books like this, that doesn't mean I'm quitting. Quitting this war that we're in for survival around the world. This war, not just for truth, but yes, for white survival. Because we're going through the Morgenthau Plan, just like Germany has been going through it for the last 70 years. We're going through it now, big time. I will find another way to fight. It won't be through books, though. This will be it. And again, man, I want to tell you, 2015 was the last time I was on. So many other websites have closed, gone under, done something, or been imprisoned. I'm so glad to see you still up and running and full of piss and vinegar and fire and brimstone in Australia. It's people like you that are winning this war, and people ultimately like you who are going to win it, period. And so, people don't hear me without you. People don't hear people like me. You're the one. You're the rostrum. You're the threshold. You're the one where we can actually show up and say what we're saying. You you provide all of this. You're the one who make it possible. And so, brother, you and your dad, I just want to say, man, keep up the great work. You two dudes are really good guys, and you're forces for truth, honesty. And they're also my friends, by the way.
That's right. I hope we can meet with you one day. And I have to say, before we plug out as well, we have a big situation in South Africa with the white farmers there. And, there's been a lot of horror in that part of the world. I understand that. But we have these so-called freedom fighters who are really terrorists, like Julius Malema, who's come out openly on national TV news and said he wants to cut the throat of whiteness. I feel very deeply. I know the Australian government has offered a hand to bring in white South African farmers into Australia. And I know we have to look after our own farmers as well, so there's a complex issue there. But I think we need to offer them visas and to get them in here. I think if I was in South Africa, I would leave. Tom, I think that I understand that the farms have been in their families for generations, but they're being murdered, and your family is so important, and yourself. So I think lock it up and get out of there. But I think we're exposing them. Whereas, many, many years ago or in the past, we couldn't, but with technology and everybody online all the time and everything, Tom, this is being exposed, these regimes, and we're going to see how far they go. But a sad thing happening there in South Africa. I hope all the white farmers just leave, because good luck feeding themselves. I don't think that's going to be able to happen, but I hope they get out safely. So our hearts go out to all those families there in South Africa at the moment. But of course, we have the Australian Green Party, run by Richard Di Natale. I'm sure he wants Australians to turn their backs on the white South African farmers and bring in the axe-wielding, machete-wielding maniacs into Australia and just unleash them on the streets of Melbourne and Sydney. That's what the Greens stand for in Australia, Bring in the murderers and the gang rapers with their machetes and turn your backs on the white farmers. So unbelievable what's happening over there, Tom. So as you said before, with South Africa included into this, it's this genocide is still going on. This plan is still going on today. So it's unbelievable. So hopefully we can try to get the word out and expose the people behind this, because we know who it is.
We have. Very much so. We both know.
Have to.
We both know that at some point we have to stop. Have to stop listening. We have to stop doing interviews. We have to stop going to work. We have to start actually acting at some point. And I don't know if the white world will not act upon this murder of South African whites. If it will do nothing, I don't know if we'll ever do anything. Now, back when Rhodesia was in a civil war with blacks trying to take control, I wanted to go over. I didn't have any way at the time. I actually wanted to go over. I'm not a particularly brave person. I know when enough is enough. If this is not enough for the white world, the slaughter of South Africans, the only productive people on the African continent, by the way, there is something in me that does not want simply to allow or provide an escape route for South Africans. I want them to stay. I want them to fight. I want them to win. Yeah, I want to continue. Let's not forget, they gave us the first heart transplant. South Africa, a nation right now that's got the highest criminal, as far as I know, the highest crime rate in the world. A nation now that is living in fear and terror of having their throats cut. I don't want to get you into trouble, but at some point, enough is enough, and to hell with the consequences, to hell with what comes tomorrow. We either do something now or simply allow it to continue, and our children and their children will pay the bill. But that's my...
Well, you know, at least fractions in the Australian government have offered visas for them if they do have to leave. And I agree with you, it would be great for them to stay there. You don't want them to leave their farms, you know. You want them to stay there. These are farms, generations of families passed down. But they're being murdered and they're being raped and butchered, you know. And God knows what's really happening there. So, you know, if it gets worse, and which we don't want it to, but if it escalates, hopefully they will be able to get out. But a sad situation in 2018 that we're even seeing this.
You know, it's a worldwide war against whites. As simple as I can put it,
is,
and it's a war. It's a war for extermination too. The Jewish handprint is all over this. It's always been all over this. Israel builds walls to keep out their problem there, but they refuse to allow us to stop. In fact, they encourage this hideous migration, this vile invasion of third world people to the white world. Of course, they want to destroy all white worlds because we've always been their enemy, their main enemy. And now they've got us into a situation where they've done a very good job, too, by the way. We're very passive now. We're allowing this to happen. We watch their filthy movies. We watch their anti-white advertisements. We know exactly who's doing this. Most of us do. Many of us listen to this program.
Poisoned. Yeah.
And yes, it's there. It's clear. It's not even hidden.
Absolutely,
it's there. It's right there. And if we will not do anything at this critical point in our existence, then I'm not going to accept that ever. I'm not going to accept what I would have said. Not as long as I live. Not as long as there are people like you with podcasts. No, I'm going to say the truth. I suggest that when we get control of Europe first, we deport everybody who came in this flood. And that means everybody, including their children. They got to Europe, they can get out back to wherever they came from. And more than that, we'll help them do that. But where the ships are going to tie up, first of all, we're going to tie up at Haifa, Israel. And they're all going to get off there. Israel already had built the wall, now they can keep them in there. They have had the greatest hand in encouraging this extermination of the white race. Now it's time for us to start doing something.
Yeah, it's definitely is, Tom, and it's become so low for the white man to the point of being mocked in movies and cinema, watching our own women get raped in pornographic videos, to be poisoned and dumbed down and sterilized and stabbed in the back, and to the point where some people actually protect the very people who are doing this to them, you know, and they
South
just
Africa.
To see, but, you know, can't believe
South
it.
Africa. South Africa is Australia tomorrow, America the next day, Canada.
It is, for sure.
There is no getting around this. I mean, it's there for anybody with a brain to think. Eyes to see, it's there. Yeah, and it's we better be acting pretty damn quick while we've got the time, while we've got the muscle, so to speak. And believe me, there are many people, many white people who are not dead yet. I know, I see them, I hear them, I talk to them. And whatever, it's we're once again faced with a crisis, and we've been faced with crises in the past. When I think more positively, I get very hopeful. We are winning this war, but is there enough time? Now we're talking time, not just ability to stay afloat and have muscle. Is there going to be enough time? Yes, there is. We'll make more time. We've always been creative, inventive, and very unique in our history. We will do it. Unfortunately, it's going to take every day we wait. It's going to take more. And the odds decrease the more time we wait. I'm at the point where I don't want to wait anymore. That doesn't mean I'm going to go off and kill somebody on the streets or blow up something right now. We'll reach critical mass. Everyone will come together. They'll know instinctively what's to be done. Much like the wall came down in eastern in the Eastern Bloc in the 80s. That's critical mass. It came down. Nobody was looking for it. It came down. When this happens, yes, we'll all know it. So, but the thing is, work for that day. Don't just listen and talk for that day. Work for that day. Actually do something for that day. And like I said, I hate to keep bringing up money, but money does drive this. People like Adam, if you've got a few dollars there, if you've got, if you're from Europe, if you've got some euros to throw his way, please do. You couldn't spend it anywhere better.
Needs to go to you, Tom, I think. I fund all this myself with the help through Renegade and my website. And so, you know, I'm just doing the best I can at the moment. But I really wanted to do this podcast to encourage anybody out there listening, you know, to put you first. I think that's you're the one who deserves it, and you need help here. So when I put up the podcast, I'll put up your website information, and I'll say here as well, looking at your website, to order the book, they can go to Amazon.com and simply order the book there. I'd say Kindle as well. And we'll go through your PayPal account as well, Tom. PayPal account. Is it just account at mtgoodridge.aol.com? Is that where people go to PayPal?
Yeah, they could do that. Same as my email address, of course, mtgoodridge@aol.com. But no, I insist that first dollar go to you, Kyle Hunt, people like that. I'm serious.
It was incredible, Tom. How many countries? I forgot to check with Kyle, actually, so I'm not going to say anything, but I forgot to check how many countries have actually banned Hellstorm, the documentary. And there's no swearing in it. I mean, they don't ban pornography. They've got pornography, hardcore pornography. They've got barbaric pornography on Facebook and social media. They've got people on social media, on Twitter, I've been seeing lately, telling people to kill all white people and all of this. They've got terrible stuff on there. But they banned this documentary all over YouTube. But it still stands. The work was done, incredible work there. And the book still stands. And your website still stands. It's a beautiful-looking website. As well, and you're still updating it very much, and so all the information's on there. $20 to get your books, pretty amazing. So we can just do our best and get that information out to folks, because you got a lot of great books. It's gonna be hard for people to choose, but I would say, Tom, if people are new to listening to this, are going to listen to this podcast, and they haven't read Hellstorm, go there first, I would say, and then get this new book that you've written, because it'll all make sense. It's definitely a continuation, so I can't wait to get into it myself. But you know, you've made it very much available. It's easy for folks to get. How many days now has Summer 1945 been out? Available for the public to buy, because this is a pretty pretty good podcast to promote the book. Pretty new.
Mm-hmm. It's about 2 weeks, I think, the book has been out.
Right.
So it just came out recently. Thanks for everything you've said. You're a fighter. We're brothers, and I'm assuming 99% of the people listening here, we're all in this together. We will ultimately win it. It's just how difficult will it be?
No, thanks, Tom, for tonight going through the points of the book. I think you really laid it out wonderfully there. So it was amazing to for myself to listen to that. Thank you very much for doing that. And as I said, when I put up the podcast, I'll put all your information there. So people just need to click there and go and grab the books and help support you. And hopefully we can keep in touch, continuing and do some more shows when you're comfortable and, you know, continue. We can really go and do anything we would like to, as well as promoting your work, so that's fine. This podcast is just really time to sit down and relax and talk about what we want to. And I think people enjoy that. So thanks for your honesty and your work. I don't know of anyone like you, to be honest. And I don't know of any books like this anywhere that anybody has been put out or been brave enough to put out. Indeed. So thank you so much for being you and doing your work. And, you know, we will keep in touch and do some more shows, hopefully. And, thanks so much.
Adam, thank you again for having me. Please say hi to your dad. Great man. And anytime you want me on, you got me on. Someday, though, I'm going to actually get to Australia. And we're going to down a Foster's or something special over there.
That's right.
But brother, thanks so much for having me. It's been my pleasure.
Good man. Thanks, Mike.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thomas Goodridge, thank you so much. New book, Summer 1945, Germany, Japan, and the Harvest of Hate. Now available. Anyone who has read Tom's book Hellstorm and seen the documentary, Hellstorm, the documentary, will definitely want to get this book. I hope they do, and thanks for listening. Good night.